26368 Real 9.
Parkfile Real 9. Can you tell us a bit about what conditions were like on the Erebus? I mean, it was sort of 8 months of almost nothing.
Yes, well, it was an old ship, and it had been in a lot of, it had been bombarding Salerno, the Battle of Salerno in Italy. I wasn't on it then, of course, I was on the Gardiner. And it had been about, and it had been in D-Day landings and so on. And there were several monitors, they were awkward old things. All they had was two 16-inch guns. And that's big guns, 16-inch shells, enormous, weighed a ton each. And
she was just flat bottom ship, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, so she had blisters on the sides, great big metal blisters, buoyancy blisters, which meant that she could get an 11-foot draft of water, which was amazing, really, when you think of the size of the thing.
And what was your routine of life like? I mean, you know, just briefly, really.
It was, you know, just going down in this forward hydraulic room and making sure that everything was working correctly and actually doing the job with dummy shells, training the Marines who were firing them up in the turret. And incidentally, a story went round, how true it is I don't know, but some of these shells were anti-aircraft shells. And when they were out in Italy, they told me that they fired one of these shells into a formation of Italian bombers, I think they were, or maybe German, I think they were Italian, and they shot 7 out of the sky with one shell. I don't believe that or not. But I'll tell you what was the true story, and that was that we understood you could see the shell being fired. It was so big, so slow, and no one was allowed on the upper deck when they were being fired. And they even had to get the galley chimney down because the vibration would knock the bloody thing down. Well, one chap wanted to see these shells go off. So like an idiot, he went up the companionway, put his head out, just as they fired it. And of course, it blew his eardrums out. All his hair was scorched off. And he was put on a charge of self-inflicted wounds and sent into depot. I think he was discharged because he deafened himself permanently. That was a bit silly.
Now, I mean, you can't have been on the hydraulic machinery all the time. Did you have any other duties or were you?
No, I was on it all the time.
So
when classes came down, Marines came down for training. So they still went on as if the war hadn't ended. They were still training people.
And what were your conditions of service like? Were they all right except for these low decks? Or?
Yes, it wasn't very pleasant, but then they could get home at some weekends and that sort of thing.
And you just stayed there?
Yeah.
Now tell me about your demobilisation, then.
I got what's called Class B release.
So that was April 1946.
Yes, because I've been working on the land, I got early release to go work, because food was short.
Actually, I think April was when you left the Erebus. June was when you were demobilised, I think.
May, I think it
was. Okay, May.
May or June. It was May. I got released for the harvest in 1946.
And what happened when you were, what was the procedure?
Well, there was a place called Collingwood Barracks that was adjoined to the main barracks, and we went up there to get our demob suits. And you could have a suit and a trilby hat and a pair of shoes. An overcoat, I think. I forget quite that. Anyway, I didn't want a suit. I got a sports jacket and flannels. And I went in the cardboard box. And when I went home, I changed into them quickly. And that was out of the Navy. But I must tell you, we had lectures on how to behave in City Street, which was rather amusing. And it shows, although I was still very young, I was easily shocked, because there was a then officer who told us a story of what you shouldn't do when you're demobbed, and one of them is that you shouldn't get blind drunk like one chap did, and he came home blind drunk from the pub, and his wife had lain naked on the bed, and he started to kiss her. He kissed her on the lips, then he kissed her on the breast, then he kissed her on the stomach, then he kissed her on the knees, then he kissed her on the feet, and she said to him, "I bet you wouldn't have passed out if it had been a very pub." And I was shocked that a then officer would say such a thing. So I was still a bit naive. Very naive, really.
And what were you to do? You'd been a farm labourer most of the time. Well, you know,
Well, I've been, yes. Well, what had happened was I got Class B released because I got a job on a farm over in Chelfont St Peter in Buckinghamshire. The farm was the department of an epileptic fish colony. And I got the job as a horseman with a pair of Clydesdales. My ambition was still to have a farm, but how, God only knows, without any money. You need a lot of money to start a farm up or to buy a farm. You don't want me to go on with
no,
civilian
life.
No,
back into civilian life, yeah.
And I had a tied cottage on the farm, and I was earning £3.16 a week. Out of that, 6 shillings went on rent for the cottage, farm cottage, tied cottage. 10 shillings went into savings for clothes and perhaps holidays if we're lucky, and £3 on living, and we'd get three of us lived on £3 a week. Well, agriculture wages were pretty poor then, and I could go on about the rest.
How long did you do that for?
2 years, and then I went into partnership with a small holding with a chap who had been in the army, old school pal of mine, and we had a small holding over near Bishop Stortford in Essex.
And was that your final career, or what?
Oh, good Lord, no. You see, the thing about farming in this country is a nation of small farms. So most of the farmers don't employ anyone. I mean, there are a few larger farms that have bailiffs or foremen. So you're very limited. You're a farmer farm labour all your life, or you were a farmer if you had any money or inherited one, and not many jobs as an intermediate. So that was.
How long did you stick the small holding?
I was unlucky because I had appendicitis, and it was either of us to sign the checks. Both of us to sign checks, rather. So I signed in my partner some blank checks, and he drew all the money out, what little there was, a utility and so on that I put in. And that was the end of that. So I lost my money. I didn't have a home to live in. And I got a job over at a farm. Oh, that was interesting. Over at Mazing in Essex. And it's near Hoddesdon. And the chap was an XQC farmer. And he said that when I applied to his job as a tractor driver on this farm, and he wrote to me and said, I need to bring your wife over as well. I want to interview her as well. So we went over there on buses, we didn't have a car, of course, and it was a freezing cold winter's day, and he came to the door. I said, Major Berry, and put my hand out, shake hands, and he put his hands in his pocket purposely. I should have realised then there was something a little different about him. And anyway, he said, a foreman would take you to show you the cottage. Well, the cottage had no electricity and no gas and no plumbing, but I'm desperate for the job because I had no money. And so I said, I'll take it. And I was there 6 weeks, that's all. But being an XQC, he brought out a contract which I had to sign, about a mile long. And I'd been to agriculture college, so I knew a bit about things, farming. And I had to sign over a stamp that I was let future people over the cottage to look at it, and that sort of thing. And then one day, during his first 6 weeks, he said to me, when you move in, there was no bathroom, he said, what we'll do, I'll get Caligas fitted in. So the first week I was there, I got into Caligas people at Watford, and they said, yeah, they'll come on Saturday and measure up. He also said they'd have a bathroom built in, there's no bathroom. So I'd moved in, and I said to him, oh, by the way, I've been in touch with Caligas, and they... So they came out on Saturdays, they made things up. He said, hey, wait a minute. He said, I said you could put it in. I didn't say I would pay for it. And I said, well, what about the bathroom? He said, good God, I can't put a bathroom in. It was this government then. It was Labour government at the time. It was ridiculous. I said, but you had 20 years between the wars where you could have put a bathroom in. Why didn't you then? Well, he'd never had anyone speak to him like that, and he wasn't very happy. Because the next day I asked him, he was sending out his strawberry plants, or his gardener was, and I said to him, can I have some strawberry plants put in the garden? He said, what, strawberries in the cottage garden? Certainly not. It should be potatoes. So I got the Farmers Weekly and I looked up for jobs. And I found one near home. They wanted a dairyman, a cowman to milk cows. And I came over and saw the chap, caught the buses, came over and saw the farmer. I phoned him up first and he said, well, you've got someone. I said, well, can I come and see you? And he said, well, you can do if you like. So I came over and changed buses and so on. And I talked him into giving me the job. And I said, the only one's naked, I've signed a month's agreement with this chap, month's wages, you know, I've got a month's notice. He said, well, don't worry about that. If he insists on it, it's a KC or QC in those days. No, KC, I mean. He said, I'll pay the month's wages. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. You just come. So I went back full of it. And the next morning, I got the lorry, opened deck lorry, put our furniture on, called at the house on the way up and said, I'm leaving. He said, you can't do that. You signed a contract. I said, well, you stick your contract. And off I went. Never heard any more of him. God bless him.
And how long did you do that? I mean, did you stay in Labour? How long did you stay? I mean, sort of, if you could just quickly sketch out your career, you know.
Oh yeah, then I went from milking cows for 5 years, and I realised I was getting absolutely nowhere in this job. I thought, well, what's the alternative? Better to stay in an industry you know, and I'll try my hand at selling. It was hopeless. I couldn't go farming, and this was farm labourer. I've had enough of that. I was going to get nowhere. I mean, earning no money at all. And that's what I did. I managed to get a job for a firm in Yorkshire called Thornbers, who were hatchery producing day-old chicks. They produced 187,000 day-old chicks a day, 4 days a week. And I went as a rep calling on farmers in Hertfordshire. And I had to separate from my wife because of I had to work in the town and to qualify for a council house, and we were living in a caravan. Oh, it's a long story.
So you settled down into life as a salesman?
Salesman, and I was with them for about 18 months, and they made me an area manager, and then they made me, they had 173 reps on the road, and three, they had 12 area managers, and they had three Irish, Scottish and English managers, and I became an area manager, and I became a Scottish manager. They moved me to Scotland. I was there for 10 years, and so life went on.
That was your career. Now, yeah. How had the war affected you, would you say? Physically and mentally, you had this dreadful experience that you didn't tell anyone about. How do you think the war affected you, and your service affected you generally, physically and mentally?
Well, not at all, really. I was quite happy. I wasn't happy in the job, particularly. I used to get exhausted. It's hard work we're going to farm.
No, but I mean, I'm sticking
it's
to the
labour intensive.
No, I'm thinking. So you say
how
the
did
war
the war affect?
No,
you not really. I didn't talk about the war. Nobody did in those days. It wasn't. We've got a very good Royal Naval Association club here, very good in the town, and I thought, well, I don't know. Mountbatten had been killed. I'd known a lot about Mountbatten and about his ship he was on out in the Med and so on. And in actual fact, I met him once, very, very briefly. Didn't meet him. I held the door open for him in a hotel in Russell Square. That's another little story, but that's all. And I thought, well, I was so sick of him being murdered, so I thought I ought to support my local RNA, my Labour Association, and I joined them. And
what did they offer for you?
Well, companionship, I suppose. I didn't want to be with a lot of old boys, you know, swinging a lamp, as we call it. Telling stories about the war and so on. As far as I was concerned, I didn't want to know about it for years and years and years. I never told anyone I was in the Navy. I don't think anybody bothered much. Everyone was an ex-serviceman in those days. So that's about it.
So you're a member of the Royal Naval Association. Now tell us about the Captain's Class Association. How did you get involved in that?
Well, that's interesting because I met a chap at Skagness. I was at a reunion at HMS Royal Arthur, where I did my square bashing when I joined the Navy. And I went on a reunion there, and I met this chap called Harry Fine. And he, to my amazement, he'd been on a ship like I'd never met anybody else who'd been on one of these ships. And he'd been on a sister ship of mine. We They're all sister ships, really, the 78, that came over from originally from the States. And we got very pally. And he said, I've just organised a reunion of my ship down in Salisbury. Would you like to come as a guest? So I went down there and enjoyed meeting them and so on. And we got more friendly. And he said, well, I'm going to increase this from just one ship, my own ship, to the group and invite them all and see if we can get it together. And then it went from there to the Nationwide. And that's how it started. It was all due to Harry.
And why is that so important to you?
Well, it's difficult to say. There's a certain camaraderie, which is very difficult to explain, really, between perhaps like all ex-servicemen or just in the Navy, I don't know.
And you're on the committee. Well, tell us what role you do on the committee.
Well, I was chairman for... I mean, we had five... On the Captain Glass Frigate. Yes, I'm treasurer. And it's always a long job. I'm treasurer down here as well, the Royal Navy Association. It's amazing the letters I've had from people who are on DEs, on Captain Glass Frigates. You know, we say that we wanted a little bit of money to... for us to survive, so we're asking for £6 per person, not as a membership fee. If you can't afford to pay anything, you're still a member if you've done a DE. And to my amazement, I got more £10 and £20 than I did £6. And one chap actually sent me £100. And we're very well off, association. We got about £4,500 in the bank.
And you're organising big conferences,
aren't you? Yes, and reunions. And another thing, out of the 600 Ds that were built originally, Americans had most of them, of course, they've got an association called the Destroyer Escort Sailors Association. And they have a reunion every year, convention they call it. And I've been going for the last 12 years. The only Brit, most of the time, apart from the recent years, that any of the Brits have come with me. And I've got a good liaison with them. And I organised them two or three years ago of a group coming over to England. And that's been very successful. First year I had 50. Then last year we didn't get so many because of the dreadful September problems in the States. 9/11, as we call it. And this year, I'm hoping to get about another 50. I've got about 20 so far.
Okay, thank you very much.